Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Incoming transmission.
Politics. Not good at politics. Surely there are others who are better suited.
Trek Politics with Mary L. Trump and Bob Seska.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the third episode of Trek Politics with me, Mary Trump, and my co-host, Bob Seska. Hey, Bob.
Hi, hello.
Hello. Today, we have such an amazing guest. I know you guys are going to get sick of us saying that because it's true every week. We have with us Todd Stashwick, a.k.a. Captain Liam Shaw, on season 3 of Picard. And Bob, what a cool guy and what a great conversation. Yeah.
I can't wait for everyone to hear this one because it's so insightful, so much fun. Yeah. We just had a fun time recording our interview with Todd Stashwick, and not just because of his nerd lair behind him. He is just, he's so funny and interesting, and he's got such a varied background from Second City and improv to sitcoms, things like that, and to heavily dramatic roles, sci-fi, and everything in between. And just so entertaining. I just want to sit and listen to him as he holds court. I just want to go to his house and eavesdrop on all of his conversations.
Yeah, or play a little D&D.
That's that too. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, you guys are going to love it. And I just also, I love the way he talked about his character and in the context of Star Trek and how the character and our perceptions of the character evolve, as well as his just deep love of his craft. It was incredible. So we're going to get to that. But first, Bob, we wanted to talk about the second episode in Strange New Worlds Season 2. Ad Astra Per Aspera. My apologies for my poor Latin pronunciation. but I just want to get your initial thoughts on the episode and just sort of broaden the conversation because, as we've talked about before, there are lots of trials in the various incarnations of Star Trek, starting with the Menagerie in the original series. This one, what stands out about this one is, first of all, it's an actual trial. A lot of the others turn out not to be. But it also grapples with issues similar to a Next Generation episode that I know you wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, first of all, this was one of my all-time favorite Strange New Worlds episodes. And I think I'm not alone on that. This checked off every box as far as what makes for great Star Trek. And the great irony about that, Mary, is the fact that most of the cast did nothing but watch TV this episode.
Yeah.
Which it was still compelling. It was still fascinating to watch this episode. And obviously, the entire main cast at one point or another testified in this trial. But it was the performances, the West Wing style emotional ending of the episode. It really hit that that last 10 minutes was really something special. And then there was suspense to it. I mean, we really didn't know whether number one would disappear after this episode and no longer be a cast member. I mean, they killed Hemmer last season. So maybe because Una wasn't in action other than in the cage in the original series, it could have been entirely possible that she would be written off the show or only appear in certain episodes as a special guest or something like that. And by the way, I do still miss Hemmer. I just wanted to say, I was sad when Hemmer went away.
Great at the end character. Of last season. That was a bold move to knock him off. And in a very moving way.
Right.
But he, he established some deep and pivotal relationships, especially with Uhura, that I think were crucial to her future choices. So that shocked me that they did that.
And it, also the fact that they killed Hemmer kind of puts you off balance a little bit, which makes for more drama in the show, knowing that any of the characters that we don't see in the original series and beyond could end up going at any second. We don't know what happens to Lon or Erica Ortegas. We don't know what becomes of them after their service on the Enterprise under Captain Pike. So it could be that, you know, any number of them could end up getting the axe at some point. I hope not, but that, I mean, again, it makes for excellent dramatic tension.
Well, I think that's one of the things about having such a deep bench. It's like the red shirts now are pivotal, important parts of the crew, potentially, or the potential red shirts, I should say. You know, they're not just bit players who don't, you know, say a line and then disappear in the middle of an episode because they got killed by something. So I think that does put us on our guard. The other thing, and sort of destabilizes us a little bit, the other thing that destabilizes us is the where we started this episode. And remember, I think the beginning of this episode was the last episode of season one. Right. Yeah. That's the storyline that brought us here. So I want to get to that later on, but I did also want to point out that one of the great things about Star Trek, and I think that's become more and more the case, is the room it gives guest actors to be brilliant. As you mentioned, the main cast, with the exception of Undish and Riley, was essentially on the sidelines. They testified a little bit. You know, they did have some parts to play, but the center stage was taken by the character Neerika Tool, who represents Chin Riley in her trial. They have history. The actor playing her, forgive me in advance if I'm mispronouncing it, is Yatai Dabadaki. Oh my God, Bob. She like knocked it out of the park from beginning to end.
Yeah, I want her to be my lawyer. I think we all walked away going, I wish she was real. That would be great.
Well, I have really good lawyers, and she could give them a run for her money.
right. And the fact that she was a civil rights attorney and that the Federation still needs civil rights attorneys. That was, I think, a big revelation in all of this. We haven't quite reached that point in the United Federation of Planets where civil rights are taken for granted or guaranteed for everyone. Right. And that was the kind of the centerpiece of this whole story that, again, as I said last week when we were talking about false flags, what a great time to be doing a podcast called Trek Politics.
Right.
With this episode, oh my God, an allegory based on all forms of institutional discrimination and racism. But primarily, I think it's obvious that it's more about the LGBTQ, specifically the trans community. In fact, you know what? It just happened today where I think Rick Scott announced, Senator Rick Scott from Florida, announced that socialists aren't welcome in Florida, in the state of Florida. I wanted to throw that in because that is kind of in the wheelhouse of what we're talking about here, ostracizing certain people because of their ideology or whatever.
I just want to go back to something you said about the need for civil rights attorneys in the Federation. It reminds me of the reaction I had in season one of Discovery to the existence of Section 31. It's like, what is that all about? You know, what is going on in the Federation that leads to the necessity for that kind of dark, undercover, kind of sketchy organization? So same thing with the civil rights stuff. I guess it's a way of addressing this idea that we're always evolving. You know, we're the problems are never completely solved. We're never a perfect union. We're always striving to be a more perfect one. And I wonder how that plays out for you. Like, how does that land for you, knowing that even in Star Trek: Strange New Worlds, we still seem to have a ways to go.
Yeah, we do. And I think it goes back to something we've discussed, which is Gene Roddenberry's mandate for the first two seasons of Next Generation. And this conflict between a utopian civilization and the need to have dramatic storytelling.
Yeah.
There's like a mechanical thing that you require to have compelling stories, to produce compelling television. And that is conflict, maybe the dark side of things injected into a storyline. Something we talked about with Todd Stashwick, which you'll hear in a second, which is about taking characters who have supreme confidence and cutting them down to size has a real dramatic effect. And we get into that about Liam Shaw when we talk to Todd. And so all these things contribute to compelling storytelling. And so you kind of have to, pull away from the utopian ideal enough to allow drama to work its way into the proceedings. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, you know, what's perfectly emblematic of that, although maybe not intentionally, is the meeting between Spock and the Vulcan prosecutor.
Oh,
They're sitting in the bar or wherever they're sitting, and they're being observed by, I think it's Dr. Mbenga and Erica Ortegas.
Yes.
And they're literally just sitting there staring at each other. Mm-hmm. And if that's all you see, it's very boring. Yeah. And it looks like there's no action going on. There's no interaction going on. And yet it works because we have the two people observing and making their observations. And it ends up being really funny and adding to our understanding of who that character is. Who, I don't know about you, I hated him. the Vulcan prosecutor.
Turned out to be an a-hole by the end. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so I think, yes, if all of our problems are solved or all of our problems are external to us, it doesn't doesn't really work. But there was one, and I agree with you, I think the issues addressed here are central to issues we're dealing with right now. Mm-hmm. And you reminded me that that happened almost 30 years ago. Or maybe more than 30 years ago, in a Next Generation episode called Measure of a Man. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because it's a fascinating comparison.
Yeah, maybe one of the best episodes from the first two seasons of Next Generation. This was an episode that determined Data's sentience, which is, writ large, it's an issue that I hold near and dear. Because I feel as though, and maybe this, I don't know what this says about my liberalism, but I feel as though certain higher species of animal deserves non-human personhood, deserves some level of sentience, and therefore protections.
Yep.
Certainly the rest of the great ape species, dogs, cats, octopuses,
dolphins,
whales.
Whales.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And so... But this spoke to, of course, with Data, a bigger issue, and that is essentially of slavery. Yeah. They were determining whether or not Bruce Maddox could take Data away from the Enterprise and disassemble him and study him and do all kinds of testing on him, essentially treating him as a lab rat rather than a sentient Starfleet officer. And it was such a compelling courtroom drama with Riker taking on basically the side of Bruce Maddox, and not intentionally. Yeah. He was just kind of assigned that role to make an argument why Data is not worthy of sentience.
Yeah, like Captain Battelle was forced into her defending the indefensible.
Exactly. And that one scene where Riker removes Data's arm still chokes me up.
Yeah.
To this day, yeah, when I watch that episode, I'm like, oh my God. There was a show on an anime series in the 70s called Space Battleship Yamato. And it was a Japanese anime series that became Americanized, brought over to the United States, and rebranded as Star Blazers.
I remember that, actually.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, talk about gateway drugs. That was one of my first things. It was like Star Wars, Star Trek happening simultaneously, and then along comes Star Blazer. Like, oh my, Saturday, you know, afternoons after school watching that, on Channel 20 here in Washington, D.C., where one of the main characters in that series, we suddenly learned that he's partly cybernetic and he has artificial arms and legs. And so they remove his arms and legs. And I remember being, 8, 9 years old and just being shocked at this. Yeah. This is the first dramatic animated series I had ever seen. And they're removing this character's arms and legs so he was able to sacrifice himself for the rest of the crew. And watching that happen to Data was so sad to see that. And you felt so much empathy for Riker having to do that to his friend. And ultimately the upshot is they grant Data personhood, sentience, so that he has rights and he has self-determination. And so it turned out well, but it's something that could have turned out horribly awry. But the issue that connects to Ad Astra Per Aspera is the fact that we're talking about human rights. Is this person who is different still worthy of the same rights as everyone else? And so as far as the courtroom dramas that we've seen in Star Trek throughout the canon, I think Measure of a Man is as close to this as this particular episode of Strange New Worlds as we've seen so far.
I agree. And I think from now on, we're going to have a viewing list for our listeners and viewers so they can watch certain episodes ahead of time.
Yeah.
So they can keep up.
That's right.
Before we get to the interview with Todd, I did want to get back to how this episode ends and how it completely defied what we'd been led to expect, because in case you guys have forgotten, Captain Pike is living on this very specific timeline that ends a very specific way. And at the end of season one, Una Chin Reilly was basically gone. She was no longer able to contact anybody. She had been tried and sentenced. And now here we are. So, Bob, what do you think that portends for what we had thought was an absolutely set in stone future for Captain Pike?
Yeah, I guess there's another shoe that's going to drop for Una, certainly for Captain Pike. And that's what makes, well, that's one of the things that makes Strange New Worlds so compelling, because you kind of have a sense of the end point. You kind of know that Lieutenant Kirk is going to become Captain Kirk and he's going to take command of the Enterprise. And you know that Captain Pike is going to become fleet captain, and something happens to Una. That's a gigantic mystery. Something happens to Ortegas. Something happens to Lon. Something happens to Carol Kane's character, whose name is now slipping my mind. But these are all big question marks. And while it's sometimes not good storytelling to know the ending already, but there are still so many endings that we don't know, so many loose threads that I'm excited to see those eventually tied up. I'm in no hurry because I really love this show and I'm enjoying every episode of this show, but we do. Yeah. It's not going to end well for some of these characters.
No. Well, we have at least 10 years as far as I can tell by my reckoning. One big question is it Nurse Christine Chapel or Una Chin Reilly who becomes the voice of the computer? Maybe we'll find that out too. But one of the things that I found really moving about the end, besides Neera's lovely parting words to the crew who supported Una, was when Pike hugs her.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And it was in that moment. It wasn't just that he was hugging her because he was ecstatically happy for his friend and number one, which of course is true. But I think also because he saw an opening for a different future for himself.
I connected it once again, the feeling that I got at the end of this episode to watching an episode of The West Wing, where you get to the end of that and things work out. And this is an idealized version of American politics. And all at once you feel a little like sad because, well, this is not real and I wish it was real. But on the other hand, I'm willing to suspend my disbelief enough to let that good feeling wash over me and to take it for what it's worth. And that was the case with this. I mean, when Mr. Pasak, the Vulcan prosecutor, asked when Pike knew that Una was Illyrian, my hands literally started sweating. I was physically nervous for not just Una, but then Pike at that point.
Yep.
Because again, it's unwritten how we get to the place and time where something happens to Pike. Absolutely. We don't know what happens to Una. So in that regard, it's still suspenseful. And then and then when Neera presented that asylum law, which was the linchpin that freed Una, which, oh my God, I got chills at that point. And then Pike's hug, just like, I want Anson Mount to hug me. Come on.
Who wouldn't want Anson Mount to hug them?
True. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
He's great. He's so good. They're all so good. And as you all can tell, we're loving every second of it. So thankfully, unlike other iterations of Star Trek, this one is still going and it's still available. So let's keep it that way.
Yeah.
And now it is time for us to turn to the just incredible on every level interview with the great Todd Stashwick. Enjoy.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You have a bird. Well, hang on.
Oh, yeah. That's Sebastian.
We don't just move past a bird.
Oh, he's flirting.
As long as you know it's there. As long as you know it's there.
Oh, wait. Okay. There's a bird.
Yeah, that's Sebastian's part of the show. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He'll have some questions for you later, Todd. That's the exciting part of the show when Sebastian starts asking questions.
When we freeform with the parrot.
Yeah. Oh, wait. I have a bird and you have a Pac-Man. Come on.
Yeah. I keep it off so as to not distract you.
Bob, I don't know about you. I don't know where to start because I've been, thanks to you, I've been rewatching Picard season 3. What a shame.
Oh, nice.
What a drag. What a job.
Wow, work.
And I've been, I started watching 12 Monkeys after we talked with Terry, because I'm ashamed to say I'd never heard of it.
No, you're not alone, and we're just thrilled that people, because of Picard, are discovering 12 Monkeys.
It's so good.
So good.
Wow.
And I don't know if you could tell, but I'm a nerd. And
I've heard rumors about that, actually.
And it's one of those shows that I would have been addicted to had I not been on it. And so it's just such a thrill to actually have part of that be part of my life.
Is that how you guys met?
That's how Terry and I met. Yeah. Yeah. And it was, we were sitting there in Washington with all of the, you know, after the panel that was just tons of people and really amazing and kind. And we were like from that first day that I walked into the audition for 12 Monkeys, we were like, could you imagine if we would like cut to us being in Washington State in front of people dressed as Vulcans? We would have got, yeah, right. Sure. Yeah, that's going to happen. But yeah, we met at the audition for 12 Monkeys.
Look what you have wrought. I mean, Bob and I have been talking about this since obviously since season three started, I waited to watch until all of the episodes were out.
Were you spoiler freed?
I was. I did a really good job of avoiding spoilers. Nice. But Bob and I were talking. He brought up your character, your phenomenal character, Captain William Shaw. And I hadn't watched it yet. So in my defense, because we were talking about the potential for legacy, mm-hmm. hopefully the next series. I was like, well, really? You know, let's make Seven Captain and get rid of Shaw. So I forgive me, but
you had amazing foresight.
I saw it. But I also changed my mind. That is one of the best, most beautifully wrought and phenomenally acted, I have to say,
thank you.
Characters in forever in Star Trek. I mean, seriously, wow. Bob and I are just blown away. And so there are a couple of things we want to talk about, and we can start anywhere, but one is, as Bob knows, I'm obsessed with the whole insubordination theme in Star Trek, starting from the original series. So there's that. And there's also the stunning beauty of negative chemistry. When you have two actors who have chemistry, but whose characters hate each other,
it's the moonlighting of it all.
Well, just because it was, Todd, it was really amazing to see a character who kind of just, you know, is right in your face from the very beginning with his contempt for these legends.
Yeah.
And he's totally right about his reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk a little bit about what it was like to play that when you're actually in the room with the legends? You know, how it looked like it must have been really fun.
So much fun. I have this kind of playful relationship with the Trek fans when they come to the table because every time, I'm going to say 98% of the time they come up to the table and they go, "We hated you at first." And then I'm like, it's clockwork. And so my new game is, I'm like, what did you hate about him? That he was right?
Yep.
Did you hate the fact that, I go, put the shoe on the other foot. You're watching an episode of TNG. Two admirals or senior officers come in without orders and tell Picard, "We're taking your ship." And he would go, "What?" He would say, "What? No." And then what if Riker completely disobeyed Picard's order and took the ship anyway? What would Picard do? And so I go, so what you hated about him is that he was snippy to your legends.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's what you hated about him. But he was absolutely being a really good captain. So it's a fascinating dichotomy. Now, his presentation was brusque, and his presentation was certainly sarcastic and rude and passive aggressive and openly aggressive and all of that. The shooting of it was a hoot and a half because I had worked with Frakes on Burn Notice and Leverage. So we had already had a wonderful working relationship, and I've been fortunate to be his actor. And Terry and I, obviously, for four seasons, 12 Monkeys. So it was not a cold set that I was walking onto. And so it was a very warmly received. And you know, as you guys saw, Jerry's a laugher and I'm a clown. So that is a very symbiotic relationship. Like clowns need laughers. So that was actually the first scene I shot with Jerry. And I had done, some stuff on the bridge with Picard and Riker. And also, Patrick's a joker. So he's a joker and he loves acting. He loves doing scenes. He loves getting into it. He loves the push. He wants to be surprised in the scene, to react to new things. He wants that. And so that scene was so fun. And I think from the previous scene that I had shot on the bridge and sort of established kind of what I thought and what I wanted to do with this guy, I remember doing something and sort of trying it in my voice and Terry looking over and going 100% that for the entire season. There with the guy. And so me doing that, and it's very scene chewy and it's very, he's very melodramatic, even in a quiet way, but that the dinner scene and the saying no scene, they wrote me a meal, no pun intended. And then they let me, the directors gave me room to do it. So it was just the stuff you wish for as an actor.
What was the green meat that you were forced to eat? It was green, right?
It was blue and it was space meat.
Oh, okay.
And
that's
vegan.
It.
And vegan.
It was vegan. So naive. It was vegan space meat.
Also known as Jell-O.
It was not Jell-O, which isn't vegan. It's space meat, Bob. I don't know where in space they got it, but it's from space.
I imagine, though, something like that, whatever it is, whatever thing they put in it to turn it green. Didn't it turn your mouth green? I mean, that was the first thing I would have thought of.
It did not. Whatever space beast they slayed, it did not stain my teeth or nothing. As I'm washing it back with Malbec.
Vulcan kelp or something. Yes, it's the Malbec. Yeah. And we knew we were in for a treat when... Yeah, they walk in, are we late? Like, no, your reputation so far preceded you into the room that I started early.
Buddy Chris Monfett, he's one of the writers. He was a writer for 12 Monkeys. And so these guys know exactly the kind of lines to throw me. And he's such a lyricist with his writing. I can always tell a Monfett line because there are these lovely crafted little playful bon mots, as they say. Yeah.
So at some point, you probably saw online that fans really embrace your character. Initially, as you were describing, we hate this guy. But then after a couple more episodes, holy crap, you know, everyone wants more Captain Shaw. And so at some point, you're going, and we talked with Terry about this, too. At some point, you got to be going, oh, well, spoiler, by the way, they kill me. Oh, my God, what am I going to do now?
Well, look, you never know how people are going to respond. And we shot it a year out, right? We knew that there was going to be a turn to the character. And so, you know, we knew that the work was, it was easy to get them to hate me, but the work was to get them to suddenly see his side and hopefully empathize with the guy. And so that, that you lean into the humor, you lean into the pathos, and that hopefully gets the audience to kind of to get him. You never know what's going to become memes. Like, it's just, that's not a thing that you can plan. I think if I was, you know, to psychoanalyze at all why they responded to him, other than my devastatingly green eyes.
That matched the space meat.
Space meat. It was blue. I'm kid and play. I think when viewers have a change of heart about something, there is far more investment.
Yeah.
When they have a catharsis about a character, there is a far greater investment and agency. Like they feel there's an ownership then. It's like you moved and changed my mind, therefore I'm on your team. And I think that's a powerful thing. We love to see characters that we go, no, like now I'm rooting for you. When Han Solo comes flying in at the end and says, you're all clear, kid, boom, he's ours for the rest of our days. So in answer to your second question, which was did when he died, like what do we do about that? I said to Terry, I said, because we started to get worried, like, are we going to get like anger from people once, because we know it was like the monster at the end of the book. We know it's coming in like three episodes. And so I said, well, let's just make an in memoriam video and show Spock and Data and Picard and Shaw, because there's dead and then there's Star Trek dead.
I mean, I don't know if you saw this on Twitter, Bob, but there's already like this armed rebellion saying that if Captain Shaw isn't resurrected for legacy, there's going to be a problem.
Yeah, it was like Tyrion Lannister. If they killed Peter Dinklage in Game of Thrones, I was going to stop watching that show. And thank God they never did. But, you know, Todd, you have this thing, this X factor, where your characters are funny, but also like dark, unstable, and kind of ready to snap at any minute. I think Captain Shaw is kind of like that way.
I play broken men.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the first things I noticed about Dale Malloy, your character in The Riches. And that was one of those things where when I first saw you on screen in Picard, I did that Leonardo DiCaprio gif, that meme with him pointing at the screen, doing that thing, because I said, oh my God, that's Dale Malloy from The Riches, which was my favorite show when that came out. It was so special and unique. But you have this thing where you were sinister, but also an awkward goofball at the same time. Like, I remember one scene where Dale Malloy is laying in bed and he's got a prosthetic arm and he's like demonstrating how he might pleasure himself with the prosthetic arm.
It's a living, Bob. It's a living.
Gonna have to check that out.
Someone has to. You know, it's funny to that. Some of the strangest responses that I've ever gotten from fans of shows. Someone said, "I felt so bad for you when you were killing your father." And it was like, because there's this scene, again, spoilers, 13 years later, there's a scene where I'm carrying my father, Red West, by the way, one of Elvis's right hands, part of the Memphis Mafia.
That's right, yeah.
But I'm carrying him to leave him to die in the forest, and he will suffocate without his oxygen tank. But I have this very heartfelt monologue that I'm weeping my way through, but I'm getting rid of him so that I can take over the family in that mafia sort of way. But they're like, we felt so bad for you when you were killing your dad.
Like, that's a very Greek tragedy.
I'm like, security. It's like, who do you talk to when yeah, I mean, it's a compliment because to what you're saying is people have enjoyed the whether it's goofballness or sarcasm or something of that I'm doing over here. Meanwhile, my character is a sociopath and cutting into Aaron Stanford's chest, you know. It's a wheelhouse.
It is. Captain Shaw's not a sociopath. He's broken. And one of the challenging parts as a viewer, because, you know, he ends up, I think he starts out being sympathetic because I'm totally on board with the whole insurrection, not such a great idea thing. And if you think about, as you put it, if you think about it being other characters, having it be done to Picard or Riker or Kirk or Spock, it shines a whole new light on it. But also, if you think about what's at stake versus what's being risked, what it's being risked for, it also doesn't make any sense. If we saw the second Star Trek movie. So one thing about Shaw, though, that was a little bit hard or kind of really difficult to get over was his racism towards Seven. That was a real challenge. How was that to play? How was that to, and I get where, you know, we come to understand deeply what it comes from, but it also seems really personal. So I was curious what that arc was like for you guys.
Well, it's interesting because fundamentally, and I think you went over a bit of this with Jerry as well, because I'm a listener, longtime fan, first time caller.
That's, you know what? That's going to carry me. You saying that is going to carry me for the next like 5 months of shows.
Because Bob's a radio guy.
That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here, Bob. It's a interesting with the Borg because they traditionally are villains in Star Trek. And so to say to the analogous, and it's again, it's what Star Trek does great. It's not quite racism when you go, these people were committing genocide. This race of aliens were committing genocide.
Yes.
And so, and obliterated 11,000 people in a day.
Good point.
From Starfleet. And so his pain is understandable.
Right.
That being said, what Seven is not accountable to what the people that kidnapped her, it's a bit of that, like she was pulled into against her will and forced to be this thing. And as was Picard. I'm going to just put that right here. Now she has owned her Borgness. Mm-hmm. And she is not ashamed of the life that she has right now. And so, it is interesting that this is the part of him that he cannot abide in her is the part that is the very center of his complex trauma. So he sort of walls it off by saying, I see all of your worth, but I cannot call you Seven of Nine. That for him was a bridge too far. But there was an immersion therapy there with him choosing her as his first officer.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So he's obviously working on himself, baby stepping his way through his journey and going, instead of going, no, absolutely not. I will not have a former Borg serve on my ship. He was like, no, she brings a lot of that fire that he won't allow himself to have because of his experiences, but recognizes that's necessary on your bridge. You need a dissenting voice on your bridge. You need someone who isn't just going to bow to your wishes at all time and be that, hang on, let's look at this situation. And we watch him take her advice. So the disrespecting of Seven in that area is only a part of their relationship. He's hard on her as a captain may often be on their first officer, but he's hard on her not because she's a Borg.
Right. Well, I think that's a really good corrective, and I'm glad you said that because it's not racism. The Borg are more powerful, and
the Borg technically aren't a race.
Exactly. Yeah, and they're assimilators.
They're a collective. Yeah.
And they have destroyed millions of lives.
They're almost a virus.
It's the ways in which
it's a great way to look at it. Yeah.
That's a really good way of looking at it. He identifies those two characters, Picard and Seven, with the Borg.
Yes.
So,
yes,
but it is it. The other reason it's an important distinction is because, you look at how Vulcans get treated throughout the course.
green blood. That's pointy-eared. Yeah,
totally different issue entirely.
Yeah. No, and you're 100% on the money. I mean that's what Trek does great. It's like you go, you take on these complexities and you take on these issues, but you take them on from the side. So if, say, the trans community connects to the issue with Shaw and Seven as a dead naming issue, then great.
Yep.
You should not like him for doing this.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You should. He's wrong. And we come to see him evolve.
Yeah.
It's interesting. People call it a redemption arc, but he is a good captain.
Yeah.
He is a good captain. He is a good captain. So is it a redemption or is it an evolution of a man? Like he's a man and people, a lot of people in the community, the LGBTQ community have said to me, he's an important character to show that building a wall between people who are disrespecting you, it's better to go leave room for them to evolve. Don't abide them. Let them know what they're doing is wrong, but they aren't just one thing, because Shaw was a lot of other things than just that issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also fair to say that it's an evolution of the viewer's perception and understanding of the character. Yes. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons it works so beautifully, because we had those two things happening in parallel.
Yeah. And my guess is there are people who are huge Star Trek fans that dead name. And suddenly they may have liked Shaw and then suddenly watch him evolve and go, oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe I can. Yeah. Maybe it is a bit of that, again, like Trek consistently being a mirror to society. I was talking because Walter Koenig is my neighbor, and so we've had these conversations about how during the Cold War you had a Russian on the bridge, during the high racial tensions you had an African American woman on the bridge, and then the mortal enemy of those seasons were the Klingons. Then you get to Next Gen, you have a Klingon on the bridge. Then the mortal enemy of Next Gen are the Borg. Then we have a Borg as a first officer. So this is showing the way.
Yeah. And Picard having a relationship with Romulan. It's like we're so getting good. There.
So good.
So the Wolf 359 speech.
Never heard of it.
So first of all, that's got to be at the top of your highlight reel. Like that's got to be something that you, oh my God, get me a tape of that. I'm going to include that right at the top. But it's easily one of the biggest highlights of season three. How did you prepare for that monologue? Did anything special go into sort of getting into the skin of someone who has experienced this immense amount of trauma, which even so many years later has informed his worldview?
It's interesting because I think he hadn't, I mean, other than probably when he closes his eyes, I think so much as in his life, I mean, he has ascended rank. Well, hang on. I just lost you guys for a second because when my phone rings, it knocks you guys off. Yeah. See how good we said? Yeah. What's interesting is so much has happened in his life. I mean, he's risen through the ranks. He's been on the Titan for 5 years. Frakes and I continue to have a fight over whose ship it is.
I saw that. That's so cool.
Yeah, we continue. But I want to posit to him. I'm like, well, if it was your ship, why'd you have to ask permission to take it? So he's risen in ranks. And I think coming face to face with Picard, which I don't think he's ever seen him face to face. That's what brought it all. That's what brought the trauma to the present. And again, that's what grief is. That's what trauma is what it's brought to the surface. It's happening again for you right now.
Yeah.
Preparation. Well, I rewatched Best of Both Worlds part 1 and 2 so that I knew what was going on outside the window. And then it's all that, you know, it's the sausage factory of it all. Like, it's all the, what I have to do is recreate what I am seeing, watching, and doing. I have to see my engine room going berserk and things exploding. I have to see my friends and pick faces of my friends and watch us running down to the shuttle bay, watching people dead, watching us maybe being Borg walking through the hallways. I have to recreate all that so that when I'm talking about it, I have images that I am thinking about.
Yeah.
When I'm retelling the story. Because again, it's like, you know, I tell you about the story about where I was when my father died. I know what the room looked like. I know what the phone call looked like. I know what, you know what I mean? Like that stuff sticks with you. It becomes dog-eared in your memory. So I had to build all that for myself so that I can recreate it. Because images lead to thoughts because you have opinions about images. Thoughts lead to emotions, right? So that's kind of what I did. And then I just get out of the way of the amazing words that, that Sean Tretta and Terry wrote. And then I do it. And then I look in the eyes of Patrick and I look in the eyes of Ed. And then you get the rest of the scene from them, because that's, they're giving me everything. And then Frakes, you know, I've talked about this. He would let me reset the whole monologue from the beginning every time. So when we change cameras, when we would do push-ins, when we, when he would have an adjustment, like try this hotter, try that, blah, blah, blah. He never made me come in the middle of it.
Wow.
He would always allow me to start the story over so that I never had to come in hot. I could just live through it all every time.
Oh, that's incredible.
It's not like putting hammer to a nail. You kind of need this thing to feed into that thing. It's like the old Trey Parker philosophy with writing. Exactly right. And so you need that build.
It was a special day. You know, it was a special day. I mean, I can't treat it like any other day at work other than, because you don't want to, like, what's the Neil Gaiman says, just don't look down. Like if I thought of the gravity of, like, I'm sitting here with, and I'm doing a scene and I'm about one of the most famous Star Trek two-parters in history.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm here with Jean-Luc Picard himself and his son. And over here is number one behind the camera. Like, one could crumble under the nerd reality of that all.
Yeah.
And so you just got to not look down, and you just have to trust the process and the 30 years of being in the industry and do your thing. And then, you know, afterwards, if this is a humble brag, but after we did the scene, Patrick walks over and, you know, puts his hand on my arm and squeezes it. And he goes, "So fucking good."
Oh my God.
I can retire. I can retire.
I just got chills, man.
I'm done. I can retire. Yeah, it was like, you know, every once in a while you get these moments in your career and they fuel you. They fuel you. Yeah,
it's like when that guy Todd Stashwick said on our show that he's a listener to our show. Oh wait, that's you. And you listen and that's, I swear to God, that's gonna fuel me for years. So
I said it in front of a Pac-Man machine and Mego action figures.
That makes it much better.
Right.
Yeah. So along those lines, though, Todd, that scene where Shaw meets Geordi was one of my favorites of the entire season, where suddenly Shaw is befuddled and nervous and intimidated. I get the sense that in real life, you don't easily get intimidated on set.
It's called acting, Bob. You know, it's funny because like I said, by the time we got to that scene, I had already been on the show working for a while before LeVar folded in, and such a lovely human who I've, you know, has been in my life since Roots,
like,
and Reading Rainbow and blah, blah, blah. I mean, he's LeVar Burton. Yeah. But I'd also known his daughter through the D&D world, Mika. She's a big Dungeons and Dragons player. And so it was like meeting your friend's dad, but who also happens to be LeVar Burton. So it was great to meet him, and everybody's just so wonderful and warm and professional. And so what was fun about that, a lot of fans were like, "You must have been fanboying." I'm like, again, we were all actors making a show, right? So it was just really cool to get a cool scene with LeVar, because I had cool scenes with Frakes and Jerry, and so this was my first time of really getting to have a little scene with LeVar, and we're like, "Well, let's play this. Let's have fun with this." And it was such a different color for Shaw that it was like, "Oh, great! Now I get to genuinely kind of be a bit of a clown." Because Shaw is so kind of unimpressed with so much that to now get to go, "Oh, he's also this. He's not just that. He's not just the we're practically a hotel now guy. He likes things. He likes exploring. He chose to be an explorer, right?" But that scene, so the story of that scene was us doing the scene. And so we did a rehearsal of it. And I think the original line was, he says, he's like, you're this or subpar, blah, 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 and the whole place is held together by duct tape. Blah, blah, blah. And after I had complimented him, he sort of read me the laundry list of how awful the state of my ship is in. And then my initial response on the page was something like touche. And I was like, that doesn't track, because touche is usually I insulted you, you insult me back. And so I pitched to Terry. I said, what if I said, to apologize for how awful my ship is, what if I said, it's been a weird week?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Terry's like, yeah. Yes, say so, that. Yeah. And then I remember saying it. And then on one of the takes, I just kept backing up until I intentionally like banged into the railing. Like it just sort of like, just stupidly like a clown. And I banged into the railing. And then LeVar goes, did you just bang into the furniture? I said, yeah. He goes, you are shameless. I said, yeah, no lies detected. And then it was as we were going through that scene, Terry was like, we have to cut to Jerry and Patrick being like, who is that guy? Like, we've not seen that Shaw. So all of that was discovered. All of that was discovered on the day. So it was a delight.
It was an important part of what you were saying before, the redemption arc. It really, I think, endeared everyone to Shaw on a level that hadn't been experienced up to that point.
Well, it was also, again, is the redemption for him or was it for the audience? Are they the ones that have to have the change of heart? Because good he point. Always respected her, if you watch the hologram at the yes, end of the that, show. He always respected Jerry, so he wasn't redeemed in his belief in Seven of Nine. And he always loved Geordi. He was very excited to meet Geordi. Mm-hmm. Geordi was a legend. But it's the audience coming along for the ride and having a change of heart to watch sides of the man be revealed.
Yeah.
And then, and the evolution of him. Redemption to me often is attached to a villainous role, and he's not a villain.
Yeah, I agree. I think that this is potentially a mirror for our experience when new iterations of Star Trek come out. When Shaw is introduced, he's experiencing hostility. He gets a lot of hostility from the people he's surrounded by. And, you know, some of it makes sense. Some of it we don't know why yet. But the people who are being hostile are people we already know and trust. Mm-hmm. So just much like, you know, what Patrick Stewart and Jonathan Frakes and all those guys had to do starting Next Generation in the shadow of Nimoy. And I mean, you know, it's almost similar. Like you have to,
you have to earn their trust.
Exactly.
And when you meet a character as auspiciously as the way you meet Shaw, it's fun to go, I don't like him. Because I'm eliciting an emotion, you know, like what we used to say, a groan is as good as a laugh when we were at Second City. Like, still getting a rise out of you one way or the other. And the fun of, you know, Terry and I knowing where this guy's going, knowing what's coming, to go, just wait. And so we were on pins and needles the night before the Wolf 359 speech was going to drop. And so the night before we were like, it's going to be interesting to see when the sea change happens in people's hearts for this guy. Yeah. And still be pissed at him for dead naming.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is complicated and complex and interesting. Cause again, I don't ever want my characters to just be one thing.
Yeah, and then there's the other dimension, too, where apparently Terry told us that this is a running gag, but he beat the living shit out of you throughout the course of the season. Compound Fracture.
Two different shows.
That's right. 12 Monkeys, you get the crap beat out of you.
It was a running joke that I would turn the page when I'd get a new script, and it was like, and Deacon has his eye swollen shut. I think Terry has a beef against my depth perception.
Are you okay with the makeup? Do you like the makeup? Is that maybe part of it too? You just, I don't imagine so.
I don't mind having that. So, quick story. You'll get to I don't want to spoil it too much, but there's a scene in 12 Monkeys where my character has been badly attacked. Boom. I'm covered in cuts and blood. I'm shirtless. I have been preparing literally for this section of the episode for season 3. I had gone into training to get into a certain physical condition, blah, blah, blah. And we waited and waited and waited. And we finally get to shoot the scene. And I'm going to throw Chris Monfett under the bus here. My eyes swollen shut and I'm all cut up and I'm covered in Karo syrup. And we're lying there and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. This is going to be my first day back. And I have been like on a very restricted diet, blah, blah, blah. And we're lying there and we're waiting and I'm waiting. And then Chris walks in and he looks at a light. He's like, hey, we need to change that. All right. Ladders come in, flags come in, blah, 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 blah. And then I'm waiting. And they go, we're calling the night.
Oh, Jesus.
We didn't shoot anything. We didn't shoot anything.
That sounds like a practical joke.
At 1:30, yeah, I was being punked. At 1:30 in the morning, I now have to go get it all off and wash off and get all the prosthetics off. So I have another hour of breakdown. And then know that we're probably not going to get back to the scene for a month because of locations and stuff.
Oh,
like, oh my God. I got to have my eyes fully shut again.
It sounds personal.
I remember the first time there's a scene where I am sort of set up by this character, the foreman, where Aaron Stanford's character is basically trying to leave me for dead because I wasn't very nice. But I come limping back just again. And makeup bloodied me up. And I go, it's not enough blood. And they're like, no, you're coated. I go, Terry's going to want more blood. And they're like, no, you're coated. And like, I'm like, okay, trust me. And then they march me in front of Terry. And he goes, hey, I totally need more blood. Where's the thing? And then they hand him this thing that looks like a ketchup dispenser. And like, he just frosts me like a cake. And I'm like, and the whole time, my one good eye is just looking at the makeup head. And I'm like, yeah, I told you. Yeah.
Oh, that's so great.
It's a fetish of his. He's really into seeing me in red.
I was thinking, were you especially mean to him one time as Dungeon Master? I mean, what?
No, this was long before that. He just, I think it's the kind of character that I play. People. Like, you know, it's like Indiana Jones. I'm comparing myself to Harrison Ford because we were born in the same hospital. And the comparisons, they don't end there. But I think the joy of knocking guys like me down is watching them get back up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like it's Indiana Jones. We love to watch his knees buckle and he goes to the ground and then all beat up and bruised. Watching them stand up, that's why we love them, not because they're lantern jawed and they can, you know, they're two-fisted. It's the ability to get knocked down and get back up again.
And there's something also that's really dramatic about someone who has a certain level of confidence getting the shit kicked out of them on screen. And
well, it's certainly great dramatic tension, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I think of wasn't necessarily Indiana Jones, but I went to Han Solo in Empire Strikes Back, where he gets the crap kicked out of him at the end of that movie. And it continues into the next movie. And so,
didn't even ask me questions.
Exactly. There's such a contrast there between this cocky, self-assured guy. And then suddenly he's in a situation that he can't talk his way out of.
And
it's
wailing.
Incredible. Yeah.
Plus they had to find a way for me to transfer command to Riker. So, you know, making my femur come out of my leg is a quick way to do it.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Just visually something.
So gross.
Yeah. So and then gross. you almost drown in your own fluids. They have to.
There's a little bit of that. And I had them like. Put it in my mouth so that when I turned, it would just go. Yeah, I want it. I wanted all that. Like Grindhouse, this puppy.
Forgive me. At some point, asshole became a substitute for charm.
In real life, has asshole become a substitute for charm, Todd?
For me?
not for anyone. Just generally speaking, I'm speaking in terms of someone
for you about me. But I don't know if it is a substitute. Like it's a shame. Like I hope that I was raised better than that. There's one thing of stating your ground, but there's another thing. I mean, there's something about social media that's like the equivalent of keying someone's car. Mm-hmm. Especially when you don't even have their names attached to it. It's like, I'm pickup truck 576. Not, no offense to people that don't pick up trucks. People don't pick up trucks. I love pickup trucks. But I just mean you can have your name be not even attached. You don't even know who's doing it and they're attacking you and then it's hit and run. And so you just have to build Teflon against that stuff.
Yeah, I think it's more like asshole is mistaken for charm in certain social media and in the country more broadly. And it is tough because I know that sort of the anonymity of it should make it not sting so much. And, you must get
it's the one person not clapping, right? It's the
right.
Yeah. And also... It also, look, I mean, we've built foundations of reality shows on people being antagonistic towards each other. And we thrive on the clickbait of vitriol. We should speak to higher angels than ourselves. It's for myself, I am never a critic. I don't love every show I watch or every movie I watch. Mm-hmm. I will not slam a show. I know how hard it is to make TV and movies. So I will not slam it. I will, over a bourbon, talk about some, I'll get deep in the nerd of it all with my friends, but I keep that out of the public. And often it's more about how clever the person is insulting the thing that they're, and not actually about valid critique.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the tribalism online has now extended into sort of what's been known as toxic fandom. And it's basically guys who insist that we all have to love what they love. And if we don't, we're the enemy. We're taking something away from them.
My buddy Dennis has the great phrase when someone is like, oh, you like that? We just go, it's like we're two different people.
I'm going to steal that.
It's just the best response. Imagine that. I was getting into it because occasionally I will take the bait with a Star Trek fan who just is not happy with the current state of Trek. Mm-hmm. And then just will continue to just berate it. And then I go, I just once asked them, are there things that you love that other people don't? And they deflected. And I said, and then I'm like, well, now I'm on it. Are there things that you like that other people don't? Boom, boom, boom. I finally pinned them down and they answered the question. I said, okay, then. Thank you for your candor. Because they answered, yes, there are things that they love that other people don't. I said, thank you for your candor. No more questions.
Yeah, it's really amazing. It's like, how could you not like chocolate? I don't know. I just don't. Or
because I don't actually pick what I like and don't like. I notice it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I notice it.
And it's such a good point, especially since Star Trek. I mean, one of the things a lot of us love it so much is because it's about being better, getting better, striving. Mm-hmm. Not agreeing all the time, but just having a commonality of purpose and, wanting to overcome our limitations and our strife between each other. 100%. So it is a little weird for Star Trek, of all things, to have toxic fandom. But considering it's been this way forever, it has always been challenging our perceptions of society and politics and all that other stuff. Have you always been a Trek person?
Yeah. I like I said, I have the Migos back there. So in 1974, and I've told this story, my cousin Tori, I remember where I was sitting at my Aunt Charlotte's for Christmas night when I open up that box and there is Kirk and Spock and McCoy. Oh, and then the other box had the Enterprise playset.
Oh my God. Look at that.
Wow.
And so my Uncle Joe and my cousin Tori were my shepherds into all things sci-fi. I had my Planet of the Apes Migos, and I had my Star Trek and my superheroes. And then my Uncle Joe is the one who took me to Star Wars. So the seeds of imagining really started early, 5 and 6 years old. And so the joke is, if you had told 6 year old Todd that someday he would be a Starfleet captain, I would say, yeah, that totally tracks, because I've been pretending to be a Starfleet captain since I was 6. So like, that was always the goal, right? I mean, come on, guys, really? And truthfully, who could have imagined that the course of events would lead to this? But the fact that like, that's all I've ever wanted to do. So is be Han Solo, is to be Captain Kirk. Like, these are the things, these filled so much of my play that those seeds, Dungeons and Dragons, those seeds then just whet my appetite for playing characters and telling stories as a grown-ass man.
Do you go through phases? I find myself with these genre things. Like, for a few weeks, I'll fall back in love with Star Wars again, and then I'll fall in love with Star Trek, and then it'll be Batman, and then it'll be something from the Marvel Universe, maybe, and then Lord of the Rings, and then back to Star Trek, and then back to Star Wars after that. It's this ongoing revolving door of
100%.
Affection for all of these things that are so formative for people of our generation.
Agreed. And, you know, people talk to me about that. They're like, you're like a super nerd who's living the dream of it all. And myself and Terry, who, you know, we were kids of the 80s, and these were our influences. We are the children of Lucas and Spielberg, right? So
yeah.
And Cameron and all of that. So we grew up with this stuff. This was the raw material of imagining. So it would only stand to reason that these were the influences that pushed us, and J.J. Abrams, like, that pushed us into wanting to be creators ourselves. And so revisiting those things and collecting the toys and whatnot, these are totems of power, right?
Yeah.
These are the things that inspire me and lift me up, and I escape into, or I cry over. They're empathy machines. We learn how to cry, we learn how to laugh, and we field test all these emotions. I made a joke yesterday at the Fan Expo that, like, when we were shooting the scene, or when I was watching episode 9 with my wife on the couch, and I'm dying in Jerry's arms, and my wife is, she's in it, and she's getting all overclamped, and I'm okay. Like, I'm fine. I know the scene, right? So I'm watching it, and I'm like, you know, I'm judging it probably. I could have said that better, whatever. I'm watching it. And then one scene later, when the bay doors open to reveal the Enterprise D, I'm like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. Yeah. And I am a sobbing puddle of a mess. And she's like, what is wrong with you people?
Right.
She's like, you nerds. You're not crying over your own death, but you're crying at the spaceship. I'm like, you don't understand. This is from the woman who has a Dune tattoo on her arm. So, yeah.
See? Yeah, in fact, I was saying to Jerry last week on the show that look on her face in that picture while she's playing D&D at your house, there's that one great picture that turned into a meme, right, of that, like, now, kind of incredulous look. And I was like, you know what?
To be fair, those were photo opportunities. They were playing for the camera. She had a great night. She was, I mean, it's a lot to just jump into, and especially if you're not familiar with those kind of games. She had a great time, and she was a hoot and a blast. And there were moments where she's like, I don't want to tell you how I kill the thing, I just do.
I know, like, that's what she said. She's like, wait a minute, I have to make this stuff up.
She's no. Like, I'm not at work. But that being said, it was a ton of laughs, and she was fantastic. But to your earlier issue, cycling through my nerddoms, right now we we set up the big the digital projector in the yard because it's so nice out. To yeah. And we have been going through the Lord of the Rings trilogy nice. Again. Oh, and yeah. and they're always there for us. That's why when people are like, these movies killed my childhood because they're not like the movies I grew up with. I'm like, you can just go watch the movies you grew
yeah.
up with.
Yeah, no
you
kidding.
Maybe or these you can broaden your horizons.
Or you can broaden your horizons. But yeah, I mean, like A New Hope to me is a perfect film, and it is always there for me. Not even the special editions, like the 1977 theatrical release will yep. always be there for me. And it will always move me, and I will cry when the throne room music begins or Binary Sunset begins. I'm a puddle. Like yeah. they're always there for me. And then, yes, I'm a big Batman guy. I'm a big Star Wars kid, Star Trek. I'm a very typical nerd.
And Star Wars was such a big epiphany, but was there something before? I mean, you were around, what, 8 years old when Star Wars came out in 77?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But was there anything prior to that?
Well,
that
Trek.
Kind of was
Trek.
Your gateway drug and all. Star Trek,
Trek
right?
Trek and yeah. Planet of the Apes. We used to go to my...
Planet of the Apes, my God.
And the TV series. So we yeah. would go mm-hmm. to my grandma's, and we would order pizza, which... That could have been the evening. But we would order pizza because that's just crack for kids. And I would sit there and I would watch the Planet of the Apes TV series. And I'm like, wow. And we would watch Star Trek reruns because it was in syndication by then. So those were, like I said, those were all the toys that I had. Because again, the Migos came out in 74. So that predates Star Wars by 3 years.
Yeah.
And then the Rankin and Bass Hobbit. I was always, but that was also 77. Close Encounters was big for me. Just again, I just like we were saying earlier, I just noticed that I was drawn to genre television and storytelling, fantastical storytelling. And my mother and my parents were absolutely encouraging and supportive of it, building the pillow forts, you know, like that were yeah. Planet of the Apes. You know, it was. It formed my childhood and informed my play.
It really was. I never really thought about it this way until you just mentioned all those amazing movies and shows. It was a golden age of, it was the kind of like the jet age of sci-fi. I mean, to have, and you know, you throw in the Twilight Zone, and you know, to be a kid who had an imagination and who, you know, wanted to look beyond yeah. where we were or where one was, it was, I mean, it's not surprising that it's just grown because of the, how it informed our childhoods.
Mm-hmm. And wonderful morality plays.
Yes.
And yeah. lessons for kids. So you take Trek and again, like not blinking that there's a Russian African American woman on the bridge. Like, and mm-hmm. we as kids just go, uh-huh. Yeah. Like, why would that ever be? Because I didn't know politics.
Right.
So I just was watching that going, yeah, that makes sense. Why is that? Didn't seem out of the ordinary to a 6 year old. And that's right. the point. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the point. And so, and then Star Wars, great, you know, good versus evil yeah. in black and white hats, you know, mm-hmm. it's especially post Vietnam, like the healing balm that all that stuff was. And then Wrath of Khan, which yep. again, that's I think that might be my favorite Star Trek.
It's stunning.
And the soundtrack.
So
look, I pull a page out of that book.
Oh,
like,
it's amazing.
Oh
I love it. I
just
love
like
it.
I'll take that. Basically, I spent my life trying to be Bill Murray and Tom Hanks and a little Shatner here, a little Harrison yeah. Ford here.
Yeah.
Yeah, along those lines, where would you peg Shaw as a Star Trek archetype? Like, for example, I'll just give you an example of what I'm talking about. You famously auditioned for Saturday Night Live. And yeah. one of the things Lauren Michaels likes to do. Just
or I famously didn't get Saturday Night Live.
That's right. And, well, one of the things he likes to do is he likes to categorize everyone who auditions into an archetype of a previous cast member. Like, oh, you're a Billy. Oh, he's a Chevy. And so.
Good Lord.
Wow.
Thank you very
that's
much.
That's judgy.
Yeah, but where would you see, how would you see yourself along those lines I'm talking about Captain Shaw in the Star Trek continuum. Are you a Shatner or are you a Riker? You know what I mean?
That's a great question. This is going to sound. Well, a lot of people compared him to Jellicoe, but I just think that's more in function.
Yeah, yeah. I disagree.
But exactly. in presentation, and again, so much of this is the credit is to the writers. We haven't seen this guy. Like, he's a Shaw.
Right. Absolutely.
Yes. Thank you, because that was going to be my follow-up. I honestly believe that Shaw is brand new to the Star Trek canon.
And part of that is, and there was, I think, articles written about it. He's the first Gen X captain.
Oh,
yeah,
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm the driver, so I am Gen X. So he's the first Gen X captain. He's the first like. Over it, like,
yeah,
so
yeah.
Gen X, like,
yeah.
There we go. Okay, do we really have so to?
I've been doing this since I was four.
Keep my head down. I'll let myself in the door because mom and dad are at work. I'm a Gen X captain, and so I think that alone, the Gen X kids that, like myself, in the early '90s that were watching it went, oh, I'm that guy.
Yeah,
I'm not Kirk. I might want. Well, that's what they were saying. They're like. I want to be Picard, but I'm that guy. Like,
do you kind of did it take a Gen X showrunner to make a Gen X captain and have it be so representative of sort of the archetype of that generation?
Well, I think much of Gen X is Tarantino and whatnot is postmodernism, right? It is a reflective deconstruction. Of genre, and Shaw was a reflective deconstruction of Next Generation.
Totally.
Yeah.
Where he, I love you boys. I really do. All your fabulous, equally irresponsible adventures. Like, he was this kind of Greek chorus commenter on them. So going back to what we were saying earlier about Locutus, deep down, he knows it wasn't Picard that was killing all of us. It was Locutus. Picard was a hostage, but I think, and I've said this before, I think Shaw saw their cowboy ways as poking the bear that put them in traffic that got him hit by the board.
Yeah, it's so funny. I thought you were going to say it wasn't Locutus. It was the baby boomers.
Okay, boomers.
Something we've talked about on these initial several podcast episodes with both Terry and Jerry is how human civilization gets to the Star Trek future, if at all. I mean, without going through too many catastrophes before we wake up and realize our place in the galaxy, right? How do we get to something like the United Federation of Planets without destroying ourselves in the process?
That's a terrific question. Well, it'll take the Vulcans visiting.
That would help tremendously.
I say that half kidding. I think something to the effect of eventually indisputable proof of sentient life elsewhere suddenly does not make us Americans, South Americans, Africans, Germans, we are Earthlings, right? We are now, they don't see us as these different states. They see, they would see us as a unified species. And and then I think that might lead us to doing it. I also think the cataclysms that our planet may be seeing coming down the road might unify us, because we're going to have to go, all right, the water's rising. Like, we're going to have to band together regardless of who we voted for in order for our children and our children's children to have a place to put their feet up.
Are you hopeful for humanity? Are you more Shaw about humanity or more Picard about humanity?
I'm a hopeful dude. I'm an optimist. Yeah. My operating system is happiness. Because happiness is not circumstances and happiness is not a place, because there are people in horrible circumstances that find a way to persevere. Yeah. Ukraine, like there are ways, like you see the resolve, human resolve. And so I'm an optimist. Again, it's like, what's the Mr. Rogers? Yeah, but look at the people helping.
That's
big, right? That's big.
Yeah. And that's very Star Trek. Absolutely. I mean, that's, I think, one of the reasons we all, when we were little kids and we didn't know anything about politics, like you said earlier, who knows that this is an allusion to Vietnam? I certainly didn't. Yeah. I was six. You know, it's that hopefulness, that teamness. Agreed. And being in it together. And I'm with you. If we can figure out how to do that.
Yeah. I think more people want good in this world than want bad. Obviously food is the big thing. When people are hungry, things go south, and
water.
You know, it's food and water. Yeah. I mean, the life givers.
Yep.
Life-giving stuff. So I think, I'm not a cynic. I'm a very, very hopeful dude. Very hopeful dude.
So there's this amazing scene with Shaw explaining the Dominion to Seven. You describe how the changelings require a pot to pour themselves into at night. Yeah. And Seven asks, pot like cannabis? And then Shaw replies, sadly, no. Does Captain Shaw indulge? Todd Stashwick.
Come on.
That's not a no.
Come on. I mean, and Jerry was so like, that scene was so fun to shoot because that was such a like a Holmes and Watson scene. Like it was so like we were sleuthing. She's so great. I just want to keep working with Jerry. I just love her.
Yeah.
But she was just so like, it was the Law and Order scene. It was the procedural. We were in a procedural drama in that moment. It was like, bah, 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 what about this? We were kind of sleuthing our way through. I just want to.
Well, now Captain Shaw is my favorite captain. Absolutely. I'm not saying that because you're sitting here. I'm saying that because of your answer just now. And I can assure you, Captain Jellicoe does not have a bong in his ready room. So let's eliminate those comparisons now.
No, that is a false comparison.
That's very funny.
All right. Well, this, Todd, was amazing. Thank you for spending so much time with us. Thank you for becoming such an integral part of this phenomenal universe that is Star Trek and for adding so much
to it. Look, we're only as good as the people we get to work with. And I was given such a gift to work with those amazing humans and the amazing writing by Terry and the writers. It's just like every once in a while you get one, and you hopefully do it justice. So I really appreciate your kind words. Thank you.
Well,
thank you so much, Todd. And thank you for the riches. I just got to tell you, it's one of those things that is just such a bummer that timing didn't work out better for it.
Yeah, it was the last writer strike that killed it.
Yeah. Killed a lot of things.
By the way, two things, and then I'll get out of your hair. Two things. the bridge of the Titan was the same soundstage as the Malloy House. I would drive to work, it was the same exact drive to work and the same walk into work. And then a few weeks back, my phone rings and it was a London exchange. And I thought my friend Hannah was calling me, and it was Eddie who,
oh wow.
She is a huge Star Trek fan. And she was like, I'm watching this and my friend Todd is doing this amazing job. And I'm thinking, I could just call him. And Eddie.
So great.
Eddie called me to just gush about Star Trek. And I didn't know they were that big of a Star Trek fan.
That's incredible.
We're everywhere. We Star Trek fans.
There was a band back in the 70s called Big Star that just suffered from horrible timing. It was an amazing band led by this guy, Alex Chilton, an incredible couple of albums. And they just dropped at the wrong time. And it's such a pisser. But you can still watch The Riches on streaming. I forget exactly. It may be Amazon Prime. I'm not sure.
Exactly. I think it's on Hulu.
Hulu. Okay, yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. And so
yeah, if you want the greatest example of unresolved viewing.
It's like Freaks and Geeks.
It literally ends on a cliffhanger.
Yes. Yes. And the neighbor discovers. Yeah. Right.
Oh, reminds me of this great story. When I was in college, I was watching Beauty and the Beast, and there's this moment where the last petal like falls off the rose, and then he goes, "It's hopeless," and it goes to black, and this little kid in front of me goes, "Is it over, mommy?"
Childhood crushed.
Could you imagine? God, yeah. It's hopeless.
Yeah. Right.
Hi, everybody.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, as advertised, that was amazing.
Yeah, and we kind of got a scoop at the end, maybe, from Captain Shaw himself about the pot on the Titan A. Who knows whether, I mean, he kind of left it open-ended, but he didn't deny it. So
he didn't, and one can only imagine that it's if you're into that sort of thing, it's very fine. So I don't think we can top that, although we're going to keep trying because in 2 weeks' time, who do we have? I still can't believe that this is happening. We're going to keep saying the same thing because everybody is amazing. So who is our next guest? And I'm glad I'm sitting down.
Well, if you thought Todd Stashwick was a Renaissance man, oh my God, do we have another Renaissance man from the Star Trek universe. Tim Russ is going to join us, Tuvok from Voyager and Picard Season 3. And we have so many things to talk about with Tim Russ because he's a musician, he's an astronomer, obviously we know he's an actor, he's a listener of the Stephanie Miller Show, which is near and dear to my heart. And so many things to cover with Tim. And not just about Voyager. I want to ask him about his part in Picard Season 3.
Yeah.
And there's something specific that he brought up with me in private that he wants to talk about with regard to the allegory of Season 3 and the Borg and how the Dominion and the Borg were able to infect all of these young people. And so, and what that means, how we can interpret that with, you know, things that we're dealing with technologically right now. So lots of stuff to discuss with Tim.
It's going to be amazing. That's 2 weeks. We're taking next week off because I think there's some holiday. Not sure.
Yeah. But something's happening.
Yeah. Everybody should take next week off.
Yeah. Frontier Day. It's Frontier Day.
Oh, Mary. Of course. Yeah. Of course. Frontier Day. So we will come back recharged, ready to go, and I have no doubt it's going to be an amazing discussion with Tim Russ. Really looking forward to it. In the meantime, everybody, have a great couple of weeks, and we will see you soon.